struggled, attempted to get away from these men. However, they subdued her and tied her up.
Anchorage police investigate a woman's abduction by strangers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 2nd of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, one Alaskan's simple wish for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Keep it wild, and in our language, to us, just to keep it the way the Creator made it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Anchorage police are saying a woman who claimed she was abducted and held overnight by strangers has a credible story. Sergeant Kenneth McCoy with APD's Special Victims Unit said the victim, a young woman in her 20s, left work late on Tuesday evening and went to visit a friend in the Spinard area. When she got out of her car in an apartment complex parking lot, two men with bandanas covering their faces grabbed her, put her into a van, bound her hands, and placed something over her head. She was taken to a building and held overnight. Sergeant McCoy says the next day they moved her again.
It was during this second transport that she seized the opportunity to escape. When the vehicle stopped in traffic, she, again, her hands were bound in front. She was able to manipulate the door handle on the van, the sliding door, and she was able to get out of the vehicle and run for help at that point.
Sergeant McCoy says her injuries are consistent with a struggle with captors. He would not say if she was assaulted while held in the building overnight. He says the evidence backs up her story.
At this point, all of her evidence is corroborating what she's told us, and we've spoken to her close family and boyfriend and so forth, and we feel what we've been told is credible.
McCoy says Anchorage police are now reaching out to the public for help.
When she got out of the vehicle, it was in broad daylight, around 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, off of West 25th, and we're hoping someone may have gotten a look at the vehicle to give us a better description or seen where the vehicle fled to, or if there's people out there who are aware of individuals who had talked about carrying out some sort of abduction of this nature, and we're definitely requesting that type of information be forwarded to us.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is now part of the lawsuit filed against the state over the counting of write-in ballots. Ketchikan Superior Court Judge William Carey has granted intervener status to Murkowski. During a court hearing yesterday, Carey questioned whether Murkowski truly had an interest in the case that Republican nominee Joe Miller filed against the State Division of Elections. Miller is challenging the criteria used for counting write-in ballots apparently cast November 2nd for Murkowski, his opponent in the U.S. Senate race. In the five-page opinion issued this morning, Judge Carey reiterated his earlier skepticism with Murkowski's legal interest in the lawsuit, but he seemed satisfied with an additional pleading made overnight by a Murkowski lawyer, which highlighted 2016 write-in votes that election workers did not count. One of the criteria for intervener status would be a so-called adversity of interest between the state and another party like Murkowski. Judge Carey has expedited consideration of the case. Arguments are scheduled for next Wednesday in Juneau Superior Court. He plans to issue a decision by the following day. The case will likely be appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court. It will then go back to federal district court before election results for the Senate race can be certified and a senator is sworn in next month. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge turns 50 on Monday, and conservationists are using the anniversary to call for stronger protections. They want President Obama to declare monument status for the refuge, a move that would beef up its protections without having to get congressional approval. It wouldn't carry the same weight as wilderness status, but would block most forms of development. The president of the Wilderness Society, Bill Meadows, says getting the president to designate it a monument area has a better chance than being protected by Congress.
The political environment we're working in right now makes everything difficult, so it's hard to tell. I mean, I think that the president really does care about the Arctic refuge. He expressed that when he was in the Senate. He was always a champion. So I think his heart is in the right place. I think the question is one of timing and whether that monument status or some additional protection might occur now or later in the administration is probably the question.
With the House shifting to Republican control in the new year, there's zero likelihood of seeing Congress pass stronger protections in the next 2 years, a reality Meadow admits.
The signals are that way, that there's going to be, you know, a shift in orientation from protection to development, and I think we have to guard against that.
This morning outside the U.S. Capitol building, refuge advocates gathered to mark the approaching anniversary, including Sarah James with the Gwich'in Steering Committee, who traveled from Arctic Village. James has been working to protect the refuge for decades and has appeared at dozens of similar events, but says she has new motivation after the April BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
We can't take that risk for coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Keep it wild, and in our language, to us, just to keep it the way the Creator made it.
Last month, 25 senators sent a letter to President Obama calling for stepped-up protection. More than 50 House members signed on to a similar letter this fall, including Washington State Congressman Jay Inslee. He says the most viable way to boost protection is through the White House.
It's the most likely short-term, but in a long-term future, maybe this becomes part of a grand bipartisan solution. And maybe it's not 2 years, maybe it's 4 years away. But it's part of our commitment to the future, and we're going to make sure it happens.
The Alaska Congressional Delegation and the governor continue their fight against refuge protection efforts and are pushing to see development in Anwar. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich blasted the letters sent by members of Congress last month that called for stepped-up protection. The Fish and Wildlife Service is currently reviewing the long-term management plan of the refuge. It's working on a first draft of a new comprehensive conservation plan, which will be out in the spring. Environmentalists have also seen that as a possible way to get a recommendation for further protections. What was originally called the Arctic National Wildlife Range was established by the Eisenhower administration in 1960. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, working to end domestic violence.
It is important that victims see and survivors see everybody working together for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
The first federal permits for Alaska's halibut charter businesses are expected to be issued soon. That's according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is working to implement a new regulatory regime for charter catches in southeast and south central Alaska. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein asked the agency for an update.
The first part of the new regulations, a limited entry style permit system, goes into effect next year. Starting in February 2011, guided anglers will only be able to fish for halibut aboard a limited number of charter vessels that have the federal halibut permit. Eligibility for a transferable or non-transferable permit is based on a few years of past participation in the fishery. NIMF's Fisheries Management Specialist Rachel Baker says the agency anticipates issuing the first batch of these permits by the first week in December.
It's at the same time as or shortly thereafter that we start issuing permits, the transfer forms will be available, so people would be able to start planning for the upcoming season.
The new regulations are aimed at better managing the catch of halibut by guided anglers in Alaska, particularly in southeast, where the fleet has been exceeding its guideline harvest level, or GHL, each year. NIMS expects to issue a total of 502 halibut permits to about 231 charter businesses in southeast. Roughly 69% of those permits would be transferable, meaning they could be sold to someone else. In its analysis for the program, NIMS projected that about 43% of the Southeast charter businesses that were active in 2008 would not qualify for a permit. That means fewer vessels fishing. However, Baker says NIMS did not expect that limited entry by itself would be enough to keep the fleet from exceeding the GHL in the future.
And the reason we said that was because there's quite a bit of flexibility in how operators can use these permits. You know, not everybody was operating to capacity on every trip.
Along with limited entry, NIMS is still working on the draft regulations for the catch-sharing plan, which the North Pacific Fishery Management Council approved a couple years ago. Under that plan, the International Pacific Halibut Commission would set combined limits for the commercial longline and charter sectors in Southeast and South Central. Under the new program each year, fishery managers would use special size and bag limit restrictions to try and keep the charter catch roughly within 14-17% of the overall limit for both sectors. The large majority of the harvest would still go to the commercial longliners, whose catches are already restricted under individual fishing quotas. With catch sharing, charter operators could lease some quota share from the commercial sector in order to lessen restrictions on their clients' catch. Baker says NIMS hopes to put out its proposed rule for the catch sharing plan in early 2011.
We propose regulations for the catch sharing plan, and then the public is invited to submit comments on that proposed rule that we then consider as we develop the final regulations that we then present to the Secretary of Commerce for his consideration on whether to approve the rule or not.
If the Secretary approves the plan, Baker says NIMS wants to implement it in time for the Halibut Commission to use it in deciding catch limits at its annual meeting in January of 2012. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
An investigation continues into a formal complaint against District 5 State Representative Bill Thomas and several of his re-election campaign members regarding campaign disclosure law and a series of newspaper ads. Alaska Public Offices Commission today rejected a staff recommendation to dismiss several complaints against Thomas and ordered further investigation. Alaska Public Offices Commission began reviewing the legality of a series of thank you ads that ran in the Haines newspaper leading up to the state primary election after blogger Linda Kellen Beagle filed a complaint alleging that the campaign members that arranged the ads did not file the required campaign disclosure reports. The ads in question ran on a weekly basis and contained photos and ended with the name and address of one of several Haines businesses, indicating who paid for the ad. They also showed either a photo or the name of Representative Thomas. The weekly newspaper for Haines, the Chilkat Valley News, said the local businesses were billed for the ads, but that Haines resident James Studley, also listed as deputy director of the campaign to re-elect Thomas, coordinated the buy. APOC law states that independent expenditures cannot be made in cooperation with an agent of the candidate. APOC staff investigated the accusations and issued a report early last month recommending the complainant's allegations be dismissed, with the exception that two of the ads that expressly included the word vote should be considered campaign expenditures and contributions that should have been reported to APOC. A November hearing saw presentations from the complainant, who protested the recommendation. No member of the Thomas Party was present. Following the hearing, the commission chose not to dismiss the bulk of the complaint's allegations at this time. The determination is not final, and the commission requested further investigation. In July, Governor Sean Parnell hired on specialist Katie Tepaz to deal with the rampant domestic violence and sexual abuse occurrences in Alaska. Tepaz says change in society is needed to end domestic violence. KTNA's Deanna Hecker has more.
The statistics are staggering. Between the years 2000 and 2009, Alaska State Troopers have responded to more than 38,000 domestic violence offenses, and Alaska courts granted more than 2,700 domestic violence protective orders in 1 year alone. Last year, Governor Sean Parnell started a campaign against domestic violence and reiterated the goal to eradicate the epidemic from Alaska during last month's convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Parnell called upon all men to stand up to be warriors protecting their families and children, and he took their pledge to choose respect. In the meantime, Katie Tepass is getting to work to coordinate the governor's initiative and to integrate systems statewide to improve services for victims and survivors of domestic violence.
My main role is the coordination of the governor's initiative within state government, outside state government with nonprofits, private sector, and within the Alaska Native community as well, and also faith-based.
The initiative is looking to coordinate victim services, providing shelters, and how services can be expanded or improved. But there's also the question of offender accountability.
So another component of the initiative is looking at the management of offenders. So what are we doing with our offenders once they're released from jail in terms of prisoner reentry programs?
Tepass offered to comment on what is needed to effectively tackle domestic violence in the state, and that is nothing less than a change in society.
One of the things that we have been doing, but not collectively across the board, is primary prevention, and that means the changing of social norms. So really working with communities, working with children, schools, parents, regarding the changing of social norms and beliefs regarding domestic violence and sexual assault.
This, Tepass said, can't be solved by government alone, but the government and private sector need to be sending out the message.
It goes beyond simply saying that it's not okay. It really is creating a new society in which people not simply say it's not okay, but they're really living in healthy and strong relationships and healthy and strong communities.
Also, she added that the faith community needs to be tapped on to be part of the solution.
It is important that victims see and survivors see everybody working together for them. So it's not just law enforcement responding because they're required to respond.
While the newly created Office on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault does not dole out money, they are open to assess ideas. While still new in the capacity as the Domestic Violence Initiative Coordinator, Tepass invites ideas how to help end the epidemic.
But if people have ideas of what their communities need, ideas of how to help end the epidemic, they can contact me via the governor's webpage.
In Talkeetna, this is Deanna Hecker.
On Tuesday, Victor Chavez Ramirez, 28 years old, pleaded guilty to sexually harassing a National Marine Fisheries Service observer while aboard the vessel Frontier Spirit in 2008. Because he was working in the United States illegally, U.S. Magistrate Judge Deborah Smith sentenced him to be deported and fined him $1,500. She also set a probationary term of 3 years and ordered that Chavez Ramirez enroll in sexual harassment training and avoid work in the fishing industry during the terms of his probation. Chavez Ramirez was arrested in November in Unalaska while working on the Frontier Explorer, the sister vessel to the Frontier Spirit. Both vessels are owned by the Seattle-based company Clipper Seafoods. He was arraigned last week, and his trial had initially been set for January. Charges of sexual assault and of interfering with the work of a federal fisheries observer were dropped as part of the plea bargain. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan presented a draft of the city's wish list for the upcoming legislative session earlier this week. As KSKA's Len Anderson reports, most of the items are capital projects, totaling approximately $220 million.
About a dozen state legislators from Anchorage's 24-member House and Senate delegation came to the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center to hear the mayor summarize Anchorage's initial project and legislation list. Among other things, it contains over 50 road and drainage projects totaling slightly more than $120 million. Almost every Anchorage House district has at least one project, and the couple which do not likely fall within the half dozen or so area-wide proposals. General capital projects total roughly $100 million. Topping the list is $20 million for the Port of Anchorage's expansion project. In a post-meeting interview, Mayor Sullivan says the estimated $1 billion port overhaul is falling behind schedule and the state money is crucial.
We've seen delays in the project, so talking with the folks that use the port every day, our major shippers, they're starting to express concern about the pace of the project, and they'd like to see it finished. They want permanent berthing. They want to be able to, you know, start operating the way they're supposed to be operating, and there's issues of siltation and construction that are, you know, just dragging on a little bit, and we want to get it done.
The mayor said the original Port of Anchorage renovation completion date of 2017 is now 2021. Sullivan thought a statewide bond might augment the legislative appropriations.
There's talk of a port bond that would encompass projects from around the state. If we were able to do that, we would be able to get, in addition to the $20 million request for the next building season, hopefully a real kick in the arm, maybe significantly more money, and get this project back on pace.
So far, federal, state, and port contributions have totaled about $285 million toward the project. Third on Anchorage's capital priority list is Project 80's renewal with a nearly $10 million request. It's actually a collection of projects involving facilities built 30 years ago with state funding. They include the Lusac Library, Sullivan Arena, the Anchorage Museum, the Performing Arts Center, and the Ben Boeke and Dempsey Anderson Ice Arenas.
Frankly, we've done a pretty good job of repairing and keeping these facilities generally maintained, but there is a shelf life on things like roofs and computer systems, HVAC systems. Some of the locker rooms and other facilities are now considered way substandard by the national measures.
Before moving to the Senate, Kevin Meyer of South Anchorage was in the House, where he served 4 years as co-chair of the Finance Committee. Meyer appraised the possible fate of the mayor's unveiled wish list.
I think a lot of the items that the mayor is requesting here is legitimate, and many of them will get funded. In the past, this book would be about twice this size, so I think they've really have honed in on the things that are critical and most important.
The 2011 state legislative program list next goes to the Anchorage Assembly, which can alter it before approval. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Congressman Don Young was one of only three Republicans to vote against censuring New York Representative Charles Rangel this evening. On an overwhelming vote of 333-79, the House voted to subject Rangel to a public censure, the first punishment of its kind in nearly three decades. Right after the vote, Speaker Nancy Pelosi called for him to stand in the House well and hear that he had been officially censured. It's the second highest punishment the House offers, one step down from expulsion. Congressman Young bucked the popular vote for punishment. He said in a statement, "I have never voted to censure anyone. It should be up to the voters, not up to the Congress." Instead, Young was one of only three Republicans to vote for a reprimand, a lesser punishment. The 80-year-old Rangel was censured for 11 ethics violations, including not paying taxes on a villa in the Dominican Republic and having hundreds of thousands of dollars in undisclosed assets. Congressman Young did stand with his party today on a tax cut vote. He voted against keeping the Bush-era middle-class tax cuts. Democrats pushed the vote and won 234-188. Republicans say they want to keep all the Bush-era tax breaks, including those for the wealthiest households making more than $250,000. They took an all-or-nothing stance. The middle-class tax cut proposal goes to the Senate, where it has slim prospects of surviving a filibuster. A jury for the outgoing Fish and Game Commissioner accused of driving drunk has been delayed for another 2 months. Court records indicate that Denby Lloyd's attorney has asked for the trial to be postponed until February 14th before Superior Court Judge Patricia Collins. Trial was initially set for December 6th in Juneau. The 56-year-old Lloyd was initially charged in August for driving with a blood alcohol content of 0.143 and reckless endangerment because his wife was also in the vehicle. He recently announced his intention to retire from the job and return to Kodiak. The city of Homer received some good news and some bad news from the Alaska Energy Authority last week. The bad news is the city's grant application to fund a tidal power study on Ketchumak Bay has been rejected. But the good news is the agency liked the idea so much, they're expanding it to include all of Cook Inlet. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the details.
It's not often that a rejection is received as good news, but that's exactly what happened when the Alaska Energy Authority, that's the state agency responsible for prioritizing energy projects around the state, told the city of Homer last week that its grant application to study the possibility of tidal power on Ketchumak Bay had been turned down. It turns out that AEA had already been considering the potential for tidal power in the area and is now planning to go forward in partnership with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on a tidal model of all of Cook Inlet from south of Seldovia to Kinnick Arm near Anchorage. Homer City Manager Walt Reedy took it as good news.
Number one, we're not the grant applicant anymore. We don't have to administer the grant and do all the auditing and all the accounting of the money. And now we're relieved of that administrative burden, but we're still, you know, assured that the tidal feasibility study is going to happen. And that was the city's main objective.
The city applied for $600,000 from the state's Renewable Energy Fund, which is administered by AEA. AEA spokesperson Karsten Rodvik says the agency received 108 such applications this year and will make recommendations for projects from that list to the state legislature when it convenes in Juneau next month. He says the city of Homer's application was a good one, but the agency didn't think it was appropriate to fund a Ketchumak Bay tidal power study with funds from the Renewable Energy Fund.
And therein lies the good news, because this is going to allow the study to go ahead immediately.
Rodvik says data produced from the study could be useful not just for an eventual tidal energy project, but on a number of fronts.
While the whole field of tidal energy is an emerging technology, nonetheless, the information derived from this study is going to have many applications.
The benefits to the city of Homer, says Reedy, are more than just a possible reduction in energy costs at some point in the future.
The city's made a commitment to try to reduce its carbon footprint. If a tidal power project is feasible and it feeds power into the Homer electric grid, we see that as a good thing. There might not be a direct benefit to consumers in terms of lower cost of power, but if it reduces our carbon footprint, there's still a benefit.
A start date for the Cook Inlet tidal power study has not yet been set, and AEA has not yet identified specific sites that might be studied. I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.